Welcome to the November 2021 edition of ASAP Nowcast. I'm Casey Quinlan, the editor who helps put together the ASAP Nowcast podcast. In a minute, you'll hear a conversation that Dr. Cedric Dark, the medical editor-in-chief of ASAP Now, had recently with Drs. Landon Jones and Richard Cantor, the authors of The Kids Corner, in the November issue. Dr. Dark encourages you to dive in on that latest issue. From The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, there's a piece about interphysician weight bias in medicine. In EM Lit of Note, there's a review of the latest in targeted temperature management in cardiac arrest. There's Dr. Dark's final column for PolicyRx before passing it off to Dr. Vidya Ezrawan, where he looks at the concept of supplier-induced demand by urgent care centers that try to replace low-acuity emergency department visits. There's also an update from the Surviving Sepsis campaign as it pertains to COVID-19. Some myths and misperceptions in geriatric trauma get tackled in the EM Cases column, and there's help for you on handling inflation with the end of the rainbow. Also, there's a look into a complicated issue, how to discriminate between immune thrombocytopenic purpura and vaccine-induced thrombotic thrombocytopenia. Dr. Dark recommends that everyone gives that one a read. And there's a recap from ASAP 21, which includes the new president-elect of the American College of Emergency Physicians, Dr. Christopher Kang. Now, let's listen in to Dr. Dark talking with Dr. Landon Jones and Dr. Richard Cantor.
All right, everybody, welcome to ASAP Nowcast. With me today is Dr. Richard Cantor and Dr. Landon Jones. Dr. Richard Cantor is a professor of emergency medicine and pediatrics, director of the Pediatric Emergency Department, and medical director of the Central New York Regional Poison Control Center at Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Dr. Jones is Assistant Professor of Pediatric Emergency Medicine at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us on ASAP Nowcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's good to be here.
First, we're going to talk about two topics from your recent article in the November issue of ASAP Now. Two topics, migraine and gastroenteritis, which are pretty common conditions treated in the emergency department. Let's start out with migraine treatment for kids. Headaches account for at least 1% of all pediatric emergency department visits. I work at a place where it's pretty much all adults. And so there may be some physicians out there only with adult patients. They may rarely come across kids. So if they do have this happen, kids with migraines, what does that typical patient look like when they show up in your department?
For us, the typical age, when you look at the literature, they'll say it's usually anywhere between sort of presentation of 5 to 15. It seems to be more peri-like pubertal age. So there's some literature that looks at it, and the average age on some of the studies is usually around 12, so usually right around puberty. That's going to be the most common age that you're going to see these kids. So it's going to be right around puberty or maybe just sort of peri-pubertal.
It's important to realize that puberty is happening at younger ages now, nationally, and not unlike many adult diseases that you thought kids didn't get. Migraines are happening, number one, and they're happening in younger kids. So it's got to be on your radar.
All right, let's go back a little bit. You start your article out talking about a study all the way from 2004, dopamine antagonists versus NSAIDs, and trying to figure out what's the best abortive treatment for migraines in children. When looking at this, everyone got IV fluid, and when we tried to assess for treatment success, it was 85% with procloperazine, 55% with ketorolac. Going back from the older data, before you get into the study that you looked at from this year, what was the perspective on how you would treat kids with migraines?
One of my pet peeves in emergency medicine, and it's also one of our basic pitfalls, is for us to encapsulate a diagnosis a little too quickly when we go in the room. Often these kids come in and the parents will say, my kid has migraines. And okay, duly noted, but you should keep an open mind. Migraine treatment, before Landon gets into the nitty gritty, it's one of those positive feedback loops where often you'll start your regimen. We'll talk about that. And then an hour or two later, you go in the room and everybody's better and you look great. And it's like a nursemaid's elbow for the brain. You just fixed it and you've got a great outcome. So it's an easy path to take. So backing up what I'm alluding to is when these kids with a headache sign in, any type of headache, number one, vital signs are important, blood pressure, obviously. And I would consider visual acuity a vital sign in any neurologic complaint in a pre-adolescent kid if you can get cooperation. There are many other causes of headaches that mimic migraines, and you don't want to miss them. So I'll stop with that and let Landon jump in.
So the late 90s, they were doing a randomized trial on kids. And I think one of the big things about the data on kids and migraine is that, like most things, a lot of times we take things and we have the adult data, and a lot of times we try to trickle it down to the kids. But it's important to recognize that there's not a lot of, you know, randomized controlled trials and this kind of stuff on children. So in the late 90s, they were still trying to figure out, and they were like, all right, which works better for headache? Does acetaminophen work better for headache? Or does ibuprofen work better for headache? And at that time, they found out, they were like, okay, well, ibuprofen works better. But that was the late 90s. And then we've slowly but surely, because there are drugs that we more routinely use in adults for migraine, abortive therapy, that may or may not trickle down or translate to kids. So that 2004 study that you were alluding to, what they were doing is they said, all right, we're going to give these kids IV Keytruda, and that dosing was 0.5 milligrams per kilo, and they would go all the way up to 30 milligrams as a max IV, versus IV prochlorperazine, and the dosing on that was 0.15. So the prochlorperazine is the generic name for the trade name of Compazine. So it seems that there's a lot more data on prochlorperazine than there is on metoclopramide. So this study, though, was on ketorolac versus prochlorperazine. And that prochlorperazine dosing, again, was 0.15 milligrams per kilo, and they would go up to 10. This is one of the earlier studies that looked at it and said, all right, our endpoint is going to be, do we have a significant reduction in headache at 1 hour? And then if not, do we have a significant reduction in headache at 2 hours if we have to give some other rescue medication? And what they found actually was, yes, for the prochlorperazine, they found that at about an hour, they found that the significant reduction in pain was about 85%, versus in the ketorolac, it was about 55%. And then the people that had to get some additional pain control on top of it, the kiddos that had to get some additional pain control on top of that, if they ended up giving the other medicine, at 2 hours, they found that, if we ended up giving them both, then we had a really significant reduction in our pain in terms of the number of kids who had a significant reduction in their pain. And that ended up being closer to almost 93% or so.
So this leads me to a little bit of a question about the newer study that you're talking about, the observational one from 2021, where it's actually looking at prochlorperazine, ketorolac, and diphenhydramine all together. And the effectiveness was about 88% or so at 2 hours. And it sort of leads me to ask the question, what's changed, or has anything changed over the past 15 years, or have we just consistently demonstrated what's the best thing for us to be using?
I think over the last 15 years, so that 2021 perspective study that you were saying, that was looking at like combination therapy. There's just more data, and most of that data is still on prochlorperazine. There's definitely some more data that's coming out on metoclopramide as an alternative antidopaminergic agent, but there's definitely a lot more of the literature that is on chlorperazine. And the dosing still seems to be 0.15 milligrams per kilo with a max of 10.
And you kind of jumped into my next question, which for anyone listening out there, if they haven't read through all these studies in the past, figuring out which dopamine antagonist is the best, it does seem that it's prochlorperazine over metoclopramide or promethazine.
Let me jump in with a historical perspective. One of the things that shifted the data point here, Compazine, I mean, I remember 120 years ago when Compazine was used as mostly an antiemetic. And it came in a suppository, and the American Academy of Pediatrics had a heart attack over all the dystonic reactions we had, and I've had them myself with that. But the shift over to metoclopramide was somewhat facilitated, and I kind of looked this up this morning. There was a national shortage of Compazine in the distribution level in a lot of major academic medical centers for about a 6 to 8 month period, and Regland, or for lack of a better term, jumped into the fray. The data doesn't really help you pick between the two, to be honest with you. It doesn't yet.
Yeah, that was actually during my residency and the fellowship when I was with you.
Yeah, I remember that. Remember that? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we ran out. It was like, all right, all of the prochlorperazine is now gone. It was like we were going back and forth from like fentanyl to morphine at that point in time. So it was like, all right, all the morphine's gone, so we're just using fentanyl. And then all the fentanyl disappeared, and then we just went back to morphine. It was the same thing with the prochlorperazine and the metoclopramide at that time, too. It was back and forth and back and forth. It was like, all right, well, what do I have?
Well, sometimes that's how we wind up practicing. It depends on what's stocked in the Pyxis, what's available in your hospital as to what you can actually use. And even though I personally have my own quote-unquote headache cocktail that I prefer one drug over another. It really depends on what's available that day in the machine that the nurse can pull and give to the patient. So the one question I have is, because a lot of these things can be done orally as well, as opposed to IV. So has anybody looked into that? Or what's your experience just trying these medications orally so you don't have to worry about placing an IV in these kids?
I thought about this. Why would you bring a knife to a gunfight? Most of these kids, by the time they hit your door, have had a couple of bad days, often with a pain syndrome, which I wouldn't wish on anybody, but also a lot of emesis. And I won't ever consider treating anybody orally. I don't have any data to back it up. I just think if I'm going to try to get the fastest relief possible. There's also the question of bioavailability with Ketorolac. The oral form of it is horrible. Don't even bother. So that's an IV drug, or IM, and it burns like heck, so don't do it. And then with the antiemetics, I can titrate it a little better, and you know, the dopaminergic meds. So my answer is I'm never going to do oral meds. I don't know if Landon is nicer than me, but I'll let him speak.
No, I'll add additional acetaminophen and that kind of stuff. Or if I don't think the kid's headache is bad enough that it warrants IV medications, I'll do oral ibuprofen. Typically, my only oral ones that I will usually give will be oral acetaminophen or oral ibuprofen. There is some literature out there that looks at oral triptans. And yeah, the oral triptans, they seem to work better for adults. That's a really good question, too, because that doesn't seem to be trickling down to the kids' data as much. They seem to be working better for adults than they do for children orally for things like the triptans. And some of the adult literature also looks at triptan and the efficacy of triptans, and does it have to do with a timing, like how close has it been since your headache started? And for some of the older adult literature, it seems like it was within a 6-ish hour kind of window. And I think that's actually a great question, is going to be looking at potential triptans. And we should probably do that actually on one of the future columns, is looking at triptans for association with success for aborting a migraine. And is there a particular time that those work best for kids? That's actually a really good question. We should think about doing in one of the future columns.
And I'd love to see you guys also maybe approach steroids too. I've seen this in the adult literature a little bit, that it may help prevent rebound headaches a day or two out. And it would be interesting to see if there's something similar in the pediatric literature as well.
There is. We did a steroid study here about 15 years ago in Syracuse. Christine Stork did it with IV steroids, and it was a mixed bag at the time. It can be done. That's an easy study to do, and they're safe. Steroids have an added benefit, too. There's a little bit of a stimulatory effect with the steroid load, and a feeling of wellness that comes with it. It's reality-based medicine, but steroids have a place in it. A word about the cocktail. And I'm glad you said it that way. I've noticed, and for those of you listening who are in educational responsible positions like residents, a lot of the EM residents learn the cocktail appropriately. But why don't you stop them in the hallway and ask them the mechanism of action of all the drugs we're talking about today, dopamine, antiemetics, diphenhydramine. You'd be amazed. You want to bridge the gap between prescribing and understanding. And it's an old bugaboo with me. I always think the EM person has to be the smartest person in the room, and that would be part of it. But they just memorize the cocktail. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, the diphenhydramine part, you hear a lot of people talk about, yeah, you're going to use this, you're trying to sort of prevent the extra pyramidal effects. So the things like any kind of dyskinesia, there's some literature looking at, particularly whether or not it seems to help with a bolus dose of dopamine antagonists, but it doesn't necessarily seem to help when you're doing an infusion. And I think most of us, I would assume, are now doing this sort of infusion where you run your dopamine antagonist over usually like whatever, 30 minutes. So there's not great data that's showing now that adding the diphenhydramine for that purpose of trying to prevent those extrapyramidal effects is actually effective.
You're also up against, we all know this, that Benadryl and children, it's almost like dating. One night you're the most popular person in America and then you're a loser. The P450 system in kids is unpredictable. For every two kids who get sedated with diphenhydramine, 5 of them are up all night and crazy. So, you know, that's just reality. I get it. But as an antidote for what Landon's talking about, all the kinesias, it's impeccable. So I'm glad you brought it up, the bolus versus the drip. If I'm giving it, I would bolus it, because you can overwhelm some of the P450 side effects with that. The last thing you need, I've never happened to me, but our audience is broader, was a crazy kid from the Benadryl, a hyperstimulated kind of kid. That would just be a nightmare to have a screaming headache and then be whacked and jumpy.
All right, well, let's shift topics a little bit to the second item in your article from November, the treatment of acute gastroenteritis for kids. And I was doing a little prep work on this and looking it up, and I was amazed to find out that there are over a billion episodes of diarrhea worldwide in children under 5 years old. And I'm like, that's a lot of diarrhea. And then when you throw some vomiting in on it, that's got to be horrible. So first of all, there's going to be a lot of overlap and concern, of course, with more serious diagnoses, because gastroenteritis is more or less a diagnosis of exclusion in our careers. So what do you tend to be on the lookout for, and how do you distinguish dangerous issues from the more benign case of acute gastroenteritis here in the United States?
The first thing I taught Landon, which wasn't much because he came prepackaged, you got to earn the right to say gastroenteritis. That means you've got to have some lower GI stuff coming out. If you just have vomiting without diarrhea, my differential is wide open. It starts with the hair follicles on the top of your head. I mean, you can go from brain tumor to strep to sinusitis to meningitis to pneumonia. I mean, gastritis with emesis alone, you go back to your primary and secondary surveys and rethink it. So all the serious GI mishaps that I've treated with Dancitron or whatever we're going to talk about, number one, they generally don't get better. Number two, they didn't have diarrhea. So beware.
Yeah, I think that's a hugely important thing. You start recognizing a lot of your momentum, I would say momentum bias kind of stuff, where they say, yeah, this kid's vomiting, and they go, they just got gastroenteritis, and you have to have the diarrhea with it. So you have to have the enteritis portion of it, and that gastro or the gastritis portion of the gastroenteritis is nausea or nausea vomiting kind of thing, but you have to have the enteritis part, because it's a very easy pitfall to fall into, and you have to constantly remind yourself, yeah.
Diarrhea, I'm just charmed by the fact that Landon called it the diarrhea. I was raised in a very ick household, and it was always the diarrhea. Eventually, diarrhea is going to want its own pronoun. I mean, I don't even know, but
we got to give the diarrhea its due respect.
I'll go with that.
All right. Well, I tend to give a talk to our interns, our PGY1s, about choosing wisely every year. And one of the recommendations that you all mentioned in your article is avoiding IV fluids prior to a trial of oral rehydration. And this is the choosing wisely recommendation, avoiding the IV fluids prior to a trial of oral rehydration for mild dehydration in children. So when I talk about this to our interns, I often refer them to a study in Annals from 2009, which finds this mild statistical difference that actually favors IV over oral fluids by about like 4% for the quote unquote outcome of failure to rehydrate. And I use that to talk about, well, is that really clinically significant in gastroenteritis in the first place? And, you know, I show them how to do the number needed to treat calculations and figure out if I avoid doing an IV on 25 kids, then one of them will need an IV. But isn't that better than doing an IV 25 times when 24 of them didn't really need it? So I'm wondering what your guys' take is on this. And if you can, go ahead and talk about the study that you were writing about.
Yeah, the study that you're talking about is the one by Dr. Friedman in 2021. They looked at like 1,400 kids, and it's a multi-center study. So they had the Canadian version, which was of this network that was called the PERC, the Pediatric Emergency Research Canada. And then you have the U.S. version, which is PCARN, and that's the Pediatric Emergency Care Applied Research Network. So you had both of these sites, and the great thing was is they were basically doing the exact same study at the exact same time. So they were able to pull this out. And what they found in terms of that, they were looking at return visits ultimately within 7 days, whoever received oral antiemetics. And the antiemetic of choice was ondansetron. So the dosing for the ondansetron is 0.15 milligrams per kilo. That's what the recommended dose is. I'm a little bit more liberal with that, but that was their primary outcome, was just looking at revisits within 7 days, like who has to come back and who has to get an IV inserted and then get hospitalized and get rehydrated kind of stuff. And what they found was that in terms of the revisits within 7 days did not differ for the kids that got an oral and were able to tolerate oral versus IV. But they did find that the group in the U.S., we were a little quicker to place an IV than the group that was from Canada. But there was no difference in the proportion of children that received IV rehydration in the 7 days following that initial visit, and there was no difference in the requirement for hospitalization. So it seems that we, in terms of, when I say we, I mean the United States, had a little bit of a quicker trigger finger for the process of placing an IV. I have a very low threshold, and this is me personally here, but I have a very low threshold for administering ondansetron to kids, because I always like to think about it this way. Try to describe, and I talk to parents like this as well, try to describe nausea without using the words, "I think I'm going to throw up." And you think about it for a second, you go, that's actually really hard. Sometimes I just sort of feel like, "Gugh," kind of feel. It's hard for us as adults to describe it, and it's nearly impossible for kids to describe it sometimes. So what they do is, a lot of times, they'll get a little pokey and a little puny. And oftentimes they'll do one of two things. They'll either say, "Mom, Dad, my belly hurts." Or other things that they'll do is say, you know what, I'm really just not hungry. I just don't want to eat. And a lot of times that's just nausea. They just don't know how to articulate that, and they don't know how to tell you that. So my personal threshold, especially if they have diarrhea, for giving them additional ondansetron in terms of hydration is very, very low.
Cedric, Zopogo. It's a phrase that we actually invented in Syracuse, where we put protocols in place when emesis was, or nausea, as Landon was described in triage, where the nurses were authorized to give an oral dissolvable dose of Zofran and then challenge the kid orally in the waiting room. We had extraordinary success with it. We could therefore sub-select the group that did need an IV. And so I have no guilt in my past about orally challenging them.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty brilliant idea. Put a whole bin of ondansetron up in triage and let them pass it out.
Oh, if it was up to me, every household in America should have ondansetron in the tap water and albuterol hoses in every room. Just keep everybody home. But the safety profile is well established, and it's a good drug.
Well, one thing I'm really happy that you guys wrote about was choosing wisely. There hasn't been an update to it from ASEP's side for several years now, and I'm just curious, are there some other clinical entities out there where you think we could have a choosing wisely campaign for something else as it pertains to kids, so that we can make sure that we're either streamlining our practices and getting rid of some of the variability that you might see from one doctor to the next, or minimizing some of the things that we might be doing to kids that we don't need to do?
PCARN addresses a lot of workup protocols. It doesn't apply to pharmaceuticals. I'm just racking my brain with all the lectures I give with picking the right meds for the right reason. Many peds illnesses lend themselves to a good deep dive discussion about what are you doing? Reactive airway disease, somebody with even a UTI, you'd be amazed at the variation in therapy there. So there's a place to re-examine. You're right.
I'd actually love to see another Choosing Wisely campaign. One that just sort of pops to the top of my head would be, it seems like there are a good fair number of blood cultures that are pulled on kids that are febrile that I really wish that we would stop doing, because I don't feel like it necessarily changes clinical outcomes. And the literature that I've seen on it is it doesn't necessarily change clinical outcomes. I can't tell you how many kids come back to the emergency department and they had a positive blood culture and now they're admitted, given a dose of antibiotics, we pull off another blood culture and then we basically just park them and don't do anything, you know, for them except just sit on them, which is not a horrible thing. But at the same time, if we just didn't pull that potentially unnecessary blood culture in the first place, we might not have run into that. So I think another Choosing Wisely campaign might be awesome.
All right. Thank you, guys. Thanks, Dr. Jones, Dr. Cantor, for joining us on ASEP Nowcast, and looking forward to continue reading your articles in ASEP Now.
ASEP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASEP Nowcast are those of the hosts and any guests. The music is Florence Price's Fantasy No. 1 in G minor for violin and piano. Thanks for listening.